Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. Just this year already, more than 70 journalists have been killed, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. 25 were murdered, 15 killed in crossfire or combat, and the rest on dangerous assignment. Right now, Syria is the most dangerous place for journalists, responsible for 20 of those deaths, many targeted to stop the flow of information. Another 175 journalists are languishing in prisons, with Iran as the worst offender. But given the vital role of journalists to witness and report the world's important events, how do they work under these conditions? How does it affect them, their colleagues, their stories? Today, we go to a live special Scholar Circle panel reporting from the danger zones. Terry McCarthy joins us. He is an Emmy Award and Edward R. Murrow Award-winning journalist. He is also a former foreign correspondent for ABC News and CBS News and the former Los Angeles bureau chief for Time magazine. He has covered the recent Egyptian revolution, the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, the civil war in Cambodia, and Aung San Suu Kyi's campaign for democracy in Burma. He is currently the president and CEO of the World Affairs Council. Carol Williams is senior international affairs writer at the Los Angeles Times. Williams has covered Europe, Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East for over 26 years. She's covered the Balkan Wars, the Chechen Wars, the Iraq War, Afghanistan, and the 2004 rebellion in Haiti. Claudia Nunez is an award-winning investigative journalist. She is the Latina Journalist of the Year for the National Association of Hispanic Publications. She's also a John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. She writes for La Opinión, National Geographic, and several publications in Mexico. She's been documenting human rights violations, human trafficking, and narco-trafficking along the Mexican border. Mark Levine is also with us. He is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of numerous books, including Overthrowing Geography, Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Middle Islam. Mark Levine is a columnist for Al Jazeera, and he's reported from Pakistan, Baghdad, Gaza, and across the Arab world during the uprisings for the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and the Christian Science Monitor. Carol Williams led the discussion with her experiences, particularly in the Balkan Wars.
I'd like to start out by saying I think there's this misconception that war correspondents are adrenaline junkies who are drawn to these dangerous situations, which I think in 99% of the cases is not the way that we get into it. You know, most of us went overseas to cover geopolitical stories. I went to the Soviet Union in 1984 to cover the superpower relationship and the arms race, and you know, Gorbachev came to power and the whole bipolar world kind of unraveled. And then I went to Berlin and covered the Eastern Europe pro-democracy revolutions, the opening of the Berlin Wall, the Velvet Revolution, and the LA Times hired me at the beginning of 1990 to cover Eastern Europe in the aftermath of the political changes. And the first story that struck me was Yugoslavia. It was overlooked because it hadn't had a revolution. Tito had died about 5 years earlier. The nationalist leaders in the member republics of the Federation were stirring up age-old sentiments and resentments from World War II. I had expected to be covering a political, you know, story and sort of brinkmanship that was being conducted in the Yugoslav presidency, but it became apparent very quickly that, you know, this was going to get ugly, that, you know, there was going to be conflict. But it was so unimaginable at that time. There had not been armed conflict on the continent of Europe since World War II. This was 1990. And I remember telling my editors at a correspondence meeting in like May of 1990 that I was expecting the breakup of Yugoslavia and that it could even become violent. And they looked at me like I was insane. The concept, the idea that people could be shooting at each other in the modern era was just unimaginable. And for that reason, you know, when we started covering these local rebellions and spats between armed factions of Serbs and Croats and Croats and Muslims, we didn't know what to expect. We presumed that we were perceived as neutral observers of the conflict and not aligned with any particular party. And those things can change so quickly. You know, one incident of somebody saying, oh, well, you know, the the other side came in and started shooting up your village because they saw the journalists were there. Then suddenly we become the, you know, the beacons for difficulties and problems, and there's resentment, and they start targeting us. It's such a work in progress how you operate in areas that are in chaos. The people who live there don't know what to expect from day to day. So you really have to be on your toes and make a daily, hourly reassessment of what's the best way to proceed and not put yourself in danger, because, as I said, most of us are not inclined to go and get between, you know, two hails of bullets. It's also not the best way to cover the story. I think most of the stories I got that I felt were most insightful were not on the front lines. You know, they were talking to refugees and victims of ethnic cleansing and people who had been pushed out of their homes for, you know, no reason except that another nationality wanted to control that territory. And those are much more telling and moving stories that give you much more insight into the conflict and the consequences of it than just standing and watching, you know, two groups of guys shooting at each other. Every conflict is different. You can't really practice or compound your experience and take any guidance from that in the next one. The wars that are going on now in Afghanistan and fairly recently in Iraq, the journalists, they're not only not perceived as independent and neutral, we're prizes. You know, if the insurgents can grab you and make an example of you, that's a feather in their cap. And it makes it really difficult to do your job when all sides kind of regard you as fair game and at best, like, you're in the way. You know, you're taking pictures of them doing things they shouldn't be doing, and they don't want that to be going on either. Another problem I think journalists have in, you know, a security sense in Afghanistan is, in order to get access to the military's operations, you usually have to embed with them. You're in bed with the military. How do you have a neutral stance when you're operating and moving around under the protection of the U.S. military? You can sort of understand why the Taliban thinks that you're against them and, you know, a fair target. You know, that said, it's often the only way you can get access, and it probably is a safer way than taking your own car and driving around behind Humvees and armored personnel carriers. One other point I wanted to make was that too much security can be a danger, too. If you're operating, as we ended up doing in Iraq at the end of the U.S. involvement, the L.A. Times security policy insisted that we have two cars take a journalist out whenever you're going to do an interview. And there were armed guards, and they were like doing these maneuvers on the highway so that it was never obvious where the foreign journalist was in this convoy, which was ridiculous because it was so obvious that you weren't a normal person just plying the streets. It drew attention to you in a way that I think imperils you rather than protects you. You always have to kind of assess what's the right amount of protection and precaution to take and what's too much and what's just going to make you a target.
How long were you in Iraq?
I made about, I'd say, 6 or 8 trips of a month to 6 weeks between 2003 and 2007. Altogether, it was about a year, okay, but in pieces.
Terry McCarthy, you were also in Iraq, and you also embedded part of the time.
In Iraq, I came in unilateral, which meant driving up after the troops in our own car from Kuwait, and we very nearly got killed then. In Afghanistan, I was embedded, very nearly got killed then, so I'm not sure what is more safe. You're in a war zone. I'd like to do a quick arc of my career just to show you how I think the position of a war correspondent has changed. I started out in 1985 in Central America, and the big stories then were Nicaragua, the Contras and the Sandinistas, and the civil war in El Salvador. And I was just telling Carol earlier, I remembered, we used to have T-shirts which said, "No me tire, yo soy periodista," don't shoot me, I'm a journalist. But it was kind of a joke because there was no question in those days that anyone would shoot a journalist because we were independent. And in the morning, you could get in your car in San Salvador and drive up to the highlands and you'd meet the FMLN rebels. And then you'd drive back in the afternoon, you could meet the army on the government side. And there was never any threat to you. And so as I went through my career, I then went to Asia and there were a number of conflicts there in Sri Lanka and Cambodia and Burma. And again, we were still seen as outsiders. That all changed, I think, first probably in the Balkans. In Yugoslavia, where the Serbs started targeting journalists with their snipers. And then after 9/11, all bets were off. In Iraq and Afghanistan, it just became extremely dangerous for us. So then you got into the situation where we, in Afghanistan, pretty much had to be embedded. If you wanted to get anywhere south of Kabul, you couldn't go on your own. You'd be kidnapped pretty quickly. I spent a lot of time in 2010 with one battalion of Marines, very conscious that I was there if you like, their captive reporter. There's value in that too, because we spend about 4 months of them on the ground in the deserts in southern Helmand. Very dangerous. It's the most dangerous province in all of Afghanistan by far. The IEDs are pouring across the border from Pakistan, and they're all over the place. And of course, they send the Marines there because they always send the Marines to the most dangerous parts. We had three guys killed on camera and another guy who lost his legs. And we had this all on film. Because we'd been with them so long, they let us go right up to the front. And this was very disturbing footage, as you can imagine. We brought it back, and we had to fight very strongly with our senior producers in New York to show some of this, because the American media does not like to show dead or dying Americans. You can show dead Iraqis or dead Taliban, because they're somehow alien. But we don't show dead Americans. In fact, for the longest time, you couldn't even show the coffins of dead Americans. As you recall, when the caskets came back to the Air Force Base there on the East Coast. We eventually won that argument. We had to pixelate some stuff. The guy who lost his legs was heavily pixelated. But the reason we fought that hard was my notion that whatever you think about the rightness or wrongness of fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq, you should always remember that any time you declare war, there is a very real human cost. There is no such thing as a clinical, sanitized war. There was one defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, who seemed to think that you could do this in and out, surgical strikes, and no one gets hurt, at least from our side. When America declares war, it must remember Americans are going to die, as well as whatever country they're going to. And that was the point of insisting we show these casualties. We won that argument, and it was one of the stories that we won an Emmy for. And I was pleased about that, not for myself so much, that we needed to show people war is really, really bad. People die. Sometimes wars are unavoidable. Some wars are justified. I don't think many people would dispute we should have fought Hitler in the Second World War. But it comes with a cost. And I think the fundamental reason for a war correspondent doing what he or she does is to remind people there's a human cost to whatever conflict we have. And so you will think really, really hard the next time you declare war on anyone, anywhere in the world.
That should... should see what the contrast is then in Mexico. Now, it's fallen off of the most dangerous places for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Journalists are still targeted there as well. How does your experience contrast with the experiences of your other panelists?
I'm not a war correspondent, and there is no unofficial war in Mexico. But when you say that we have a war against drugs, then you have a victims. In my case, I think, unfortunately, journalism is dying in Mexico, not just the victims. It's the press who's victimized under corruption, under cartels. I don't even recognize my country when I have to work over there. One of the kind of most touching experiences that I experienced, it was actually last year. I was covering a story on the connection between tribes, the Tohono tribes. There's indigenous, Native American indigenous, on the border, the area, it's Arizona. And my story was about the connection between the tribe and the cartels, how this is not just about immigrants, how this is not just about people from Mexico. This is an international business. This is a business that involves Native Americans, Americans, people from... This is an international phenomenon. I was covering that story, and I received a phone call. And that phone call was my mother, and her voice was shocking, and she told me that she was in a hotel with my dad and my sister. My father is a journalist, is a photojournalist in Mexico. They were hiding, and my uncle was kidnapping, and my dad has a death threat too. I'm in this side of the border, cover this story, and my own family is living this situation. It's not there's no border anymore. It's something that is touching every single family in America. I have interviewed kids here in Los Angeles who has received death threats by the cartels. So this is a situation that involves no a faraway place. This is something that is happening in every single neighborhood, to every single families, immigrants' families here. I think that's really particular compared to other situations.
Issues with what you said. One is that your family are journalists in Mexico. Are they covering the narco wars? And is that why they're under threat?
In Mexico, especially the local media outlets are the one who are targeting their focus. I mean, still there is kind of line between journalists from the capital or the national, the kind of the mainstream media in Mexico, and the local ones. And unfortunately, the local ones are the more vulnerable because they don't have any kind of protections. And even if you are a photojournalist, you have to cover all kind of situations, and you have to work with them or you're dead. And this is something that is actually an internal debate. How can we ensure that journalism is still alive when you have this situation, when you have this kind of control in media outlets? Saying there is journalism at local level, it's a myth. It's a big lie right now.
The last thing I wanted to ask you before we move to hear Mark Levine's experience is something I read in an interview with you where you said you had to hide so many aspects of your life when you were reporting, and your journalism friends were to hide photos of your family, take your wedding ring off, so that nobody else is vulnerable.
Having covered the border for more than a decade, and, you know, it was back in time, you can go to Tijuana and cover an education issue or immigration. Immigration is always really human. There's too much human involved in this, because when you cover people who cross by the desert or by the river, there is always, it's very touching. But right now, because the control of the cartels is beyond that. And I noticed the change when I was covering a story about immigrant women, and suddenly I receive an order that I can cross, or I can go to that particular wave after 5 o'clock. And I was like, why not? Because now it's other business. It's other business in charge. And that was back in 2006. And then I noticed that the border is changing. The control is not anymore about, you know, immigrants crossing back and forward. There is another business here. So even me, I can't even go to that place anymore, because now it's under the cartels. And the people are afraid to talk. The mothers, the fathers, and then you have if you go to the police department, they don't provide any protection because they work for the cartels. You can interview family because they're afraid. The kids are the one who are the killers. You have 13-year-old, 12-year-old killers. So it's a different scenario. It's a different situation. You can trust anyone when you cover this.
I think trust is going to be a very key thing to talk about here, both about how you find trusted sources, but also how you develop trust with people. Before we go to that, Mark Levine, you have a completely different situation than all three of these panelists as a scholar.
I mean, first of all, I think the other thing with trust is, especially if you're the Westerner going into Iraq or going into Pakistan, and you want to help uncover the reality and share it with the world. But of course, you're putting a lot of people's lives in danger that are working with you. And I've been dying to get back to Iraq for years, but all of my friends there just say, please don't come. You know, it's too dangerous for you to come back. And I sympathize, because I remember how bad it was being there. But of course, what does that do to the story if you can't get back? And one of my experiences, perhaps as a scholar, because what I try to do is, as a journalist, is try to bring my background as a historian into studying the contemporary events I'm experiencing, to try to bring a deeper view that, you know, journalists who might be much better journalists than I am may not have the historical depth or the sociological depth, although some actually do, even better than I do. But in general, that would be what I can help. But you have to be there to see it. You know, you have to be on the ground to see it. And what's changed, I think, in the last 5 or 6 years, even in some cases the last 2 or 3 years, is the difficulty of even getting there. In 2010, I showed up in Bahrain without a visa. They looked at me a little funny and still let me in, and that was when the Saudis invaded. And I went back in 2011, and I spoke to the Bahraini embassy before I left. And they said, no problem, you don't need a visa, just show up. And I got to I landed 3 a.m. I went to the border control at the airport, and they looked at me a little funny and then went on their smartphone, and that was the end of that. I didn't get anywhere out of the airport. And so technology, it's making it much harder. I can't get back into Iraq unless I want to put a lot of people in danger that I don't want to. Every single government in the region has reason to and can very easily find out who you are. I mean, I have a column with Al Jazeera. I'm pretty visible, and they can Google me in 1 second. I'm sure they can do it with anyone here. So if they don't want to let you in, you're not going to get in. And if they do let you in because you have extensive contacts, then you're being monitored. So your freedom to move and meet with people is constricted. So it's much harder now to do the work that I think journalists desperately need to be doing. And some of that role is being filled by local citizen journalists with the rise of smartphones and the ability to do that. But they are just ruthlessly targeted by security forces. I've spent a lot of time in Egypt before and after the uprising there, and also in Tunisia, never mind Bahrain, Palestine, where have you. You know, citizen journalists are just completely at the prey, at the mercy of police. And while as a foreign journalist you might get threatened or beat up a little, you know, in general, in those places, Syria is a very different story, but you're not going to get shot or really horribly beaten, but they shoot, arrest, torture them with impunity. So it seems to me in some ways that the regimes right now, at least in the Middle East, the area I know, have the upper hand in their ability to manage who can go there and who can get out the story. And it is important. I don't think it's enough. Well, I don't think I can ever cover a place like Egypt or Bahrain or Syria as well as a local person can. Certainly not. Even if you know the language, it's not your town. It's not your place. But it is true that the story doesn't get out nearly as ubiquitously, doesn't get nearly the attention when it's just a local journalist trying to bring it to a foreign audience rather than one of our locals being there to bring it to us. So this is something we haven't figured out how to do. And it also puts, I think, the craft of journalism in danger. And beyond all that, then once you're there, it still is the situation where I remember, you know, just last time being in Tahrir Square, even, which isn't a war zone, but suddenly it was a war zone. People are shooting, knives and, you know, spears are being thrown. I mean, you don't know, you're just there interviewing someone and suddenly you're in the middle of a war zone in 1 second. And you think you know the language, you know the terrain, you're with friends who you're with all the time, you know, but you don't know. And you have no idea what to do. But if you're not there, you're not getting that story. So that aspect never changes. But the challenges of doing it well, I think, have gotten even harder in the last decade.
Now, you've developed friends in the Middle East over a long period of time. What about, first of all, developing new sources if you're just dropped into a place? And it sounds like, Carol, this is something that you had to do a few times, move from place to place. How do you find sources that you think are telling you the truth that you can trust and to gain their trust? And then did you completely avoid certain things and then miss the story for your safety?
I think in the Balkans, because that was the first conflict outside of the Middle East in recent times, and I was able to start covering that from the very beginning, I developed sources from mutual friends. The Associated Press, which I worked for 10 years before the LA Times hired me, has, you know, a network of in-country nationals who are their main correspondents. They put me in touch with their brothers-in-law and people who could translate for me or drive for me or, you know, guide me to the people I needed to talk with. And at least at the beginning, before it became a shooting war, there were intellectuals and historians and people who were kind of, you know, the voice of integrity on each side and in each republic. So I was always very confident about the reliability and trustworthiness of the people I worked with there. And, you know, as the conflict moved from republic to republic, again in Bosnia, I had met the woman who was my translator for most of the time I worked there early on when she was studying in Zagreb, and I didn't have any problems with the people I worked with there. I went to Afghanistan a few times when it was under Soviet occupation when I was based in Moscow, but when I went right after the U.S. invasion in the end of 2001, I just inherited, you know, a translator and a driver and a housekeeper because there was no place to stay. There were no hotels at the time. So we rented a house, and there was some, you know, relative of our translator who cooked and cleaned. But we went through a few people who I was always a little uncomfortable with because I hadn't vetted them. The guy who had come in with the U.S. invasion in October of 2001 had a reputation for just kind of like grabbing the first person through the door. Even back then, there was an ulterior motive for getting inside of a Western news operation. You know, you kind of work through it. There tends to be a community of foreign correspondents that always end up in the same hot spots. And if you were having a problem with a translator or somebody else who was assisting you, you could work with your friend from BBC or the Boston Globe and figure out what to do instead. There have been circumstances in both Iraq and Afghanistan where journalists, assistants, or fixers, as they're often called, were working for the other side and basically imperiled them. They would inform the insurgents where they could be found, and there were some kidnappings and, you know, confrontations that occurred because there was not, you know, a really good bond of trust and experience with the people they were working with. But, you know, for the most part, you know, there's always a whole lot of people in these chaotic areas who want work, and for the most part they're reliable, and, you know, you have common interests in getting your work done, you know, getting to sources, getting interviews, getting your stories written and transmitted. I mean, a lot of this interface is often technical. You know, if you're working out of a hotel that doesn't have any electricity, you know, you've got to figure out how to relay your copy to your desk.
Terry, one of the pieces you wrote, you talked about hearing about a massacre and not being able to go there because of safety issues. How do you verify that? And if you don't verify it, you can't record it. How do you deal with trusted sources, developing trust, verifying this information when your life is at risk?
I think one of the great problems that has emerged in covering the Iraq and the Afghanistan conflicts was precisely that lack of access. There were many stories that we could not cover as Westerners. Probably the greatest unwritten story about foreign media coverage is the function of these fixers that Carol talks about. Some of them are perhaps less than reliable, but in general, we cannot function without them. And there were many times in Iraq where we just couldn't go to places where something had happened and our local staff would go. I was at ABC at the time. We lost a cameraman and a sound man precisely for that reason, that they had gone out and got caught in something and were killed. So it behoves us all to remember, you see the Western bylines in your newspapers or on your TV screens. Behind those bylines are many locals who can be incredibly brave and who are motivated sometimes by money, but also a lot of these people, they really want to get that story out because their country is going through tremendously tough times. And you're seeing the same thing happen in Syria now, where Syrians are passing information out because they want somebody to help them fix it. And they know that their own government is not going to do it, be it Bashar Assad or Al-Qaeda or whoever it might be. And so they come very bravely to Western news organizations to help us out. I have huge respect for all these local fixers whose names are never known. We all know Dith Pran from the movie The Killing Fields, but there are thousands of Dith Prans out there whose names will never be known, but without whom we could never get you the stories that you've seen. So I have a lot of time for local fixers. I place huge trust. Many times they are the people that save your lives. And I've gone through situations where without a local fixer, something very, very bad could have happened. They understand the local situation. They'll tell you, Terry, get out now. And if you don't listen to them, you're foolish. So all I can do is take off my hat to those many thousands of unnamed men and women who've helped us to get stories out of some very, very dangerous parts of the world.
Are there local fixers in Mexico? You're from Mexico, so you already have a whole host of sources. Do you face that same situation?
I feel privileged because I'm an immigrant myself. So I know the issues. I know the places. I know the people. I know the language. And I know what is beyond the language. What is the expression? What is the feeling of my people? Because there are my people. I don't use fixers. I go directly to the communities. I don't even want to go when somebody tells me, oh, you need to go to this organization. I avoid that organization. I go to other totally different place because that's the only way that you can get the reality. I know this because there is a lot of my colleagues who, when they report, is the same source of information because it's the same fixer in some ways, you know, this local organization. But when you know the language and when you know the people, you have this huge vision about what's happening. And at the same time, I feel privileged because I work for Hispanic media. And it's a very particular situation because I'm telling the story to someone who is already an expert on that issue. If I tell the story about immigrants, I tell my story to another immigrant. So if my story, it's, you know, they don't accurate, they're going to tell me, what are you talking about? That's not a reality. So with ethnic media, it's a different situation. And you have to feel as an immigrant to tell your story.
One of the aspects that both Mark Levine mentioned and Claudia had mentioned to me before is now this role of social media and how it interacts with the work that all of you are doing as professionals. Another issue is, doesn't the international community owe the journalism profession some kind of protection? But if you take that protection, it's kind of like the embedded issue. Do you then sacrifice some aspect of your independence?
I would say a couple of things. First of all, Claudia, I think the only thing worse than reporting to people who are experts, as you would do with Hispanic immigrants, is to report to people who think they're experts but don't really know anything but have very strong opinions, which is what I wind up having to report to. So I would much rather be on your side than my side. Your question, I think, is really good. The United States was targeting journalists, right? They targeted Al Jazeera bureaus. I mean, the Israeli government, so-called Western civilized as opposed to savage governments, have targeted journalists, and targeting for arrest, targeting for death. I think in some cases, maybe not white journalists, they'll target the Arab journalists or whomever, but how are we going to speak to this, we in the West, you need to defend journalists, when we're not defending journalists? We're in fact making their lives much more difficult. So I think there are rules that exist. There are IFEX and Committee to Protect Journalists and other organizations around the world who are documenting the abuses against journalists. The problem is that there's a conspiracy of the powerful globally. That's whether it's governments, non-state actors, terrorists, narco-traffickers. It's in no one's interest to protect journalists because journalists are just pains in the ass who, you know, keep the powerful, whether they're within or without states, from getting away with what they're trying to get away with. So I don't think we can expect anything. I think, you know, the increasing corporatization of journalism has made it harder to be protected and harder to get the stories done. I'm very lucky, as you said, I'm a scholar. When I've gone to Iraq or Palestine or Pakistan or wherever I'm going to look at a story I want to do. And I'm not on a deadline and I'm not on an assignment, usually, from someone else. So I have a luxury that I'm sure my colleagues didn't have, and that allows me to search out the people who aren't being found and who aren't being spoken to. And that makes it perhaps easier to negotiate new contacts and not fall into the same traps. But I don't expect any government or any body to do anything more than pay lip service. And in fact, I think right now it's important to stress with the NDAA, of course, everyone here is a KPFK listener, you know, knows about this. And the attempts globally just to silence journalists, it's just much harder to do our job and feel that we'll be protected by the governments who we thought we could put our faith in.
Carol?
Any journalist would claim that, you know, we're able to get to every story. Everything is a calculation and a trade-off. You know, you have to weigh the risks against the potential benefits. If you're going to drive through, you know, 100 miles of hellaciously dangerous territory to go interview, you know, a poet about how culture has changed in the midst of war, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Or you just think outside the box. You know, if you want to go from point A to point B and in the middle it's very dangerous, maybe you take three times as long to drive around and go through areas where there's less risk. In terms of being under government cover and protection, I have to say, you know, the most miserable experiences in my reporting life have been embedding with U.S. military. It's a constant censorship, who you can talk with, what you can ask them, who's standing around and listening to what they say and intimidating them from saying what they really think. It's not worth it. You know, you go through all of this restriction and torture, basically, to get nothing. I find it very aggravating. I know Terry was saying that if you have the opportunity to spend a long period of time embedded with the troops as opposed to the fixers and the minders, not fixers, but, you know, the military has an army of people whose job it is to control everything you see and hear and think when you're in their presence, and it just seldom results in anything valuable. But if you do have the opportunity to really drill down and spend some time with the foot soldiers, the people who are fighting the war that we've declared there, I'm sure that's much more valuable.
What about some kind of international effort? What if it was, I mean, not that the United Nations is particularly objective either, but what if there was some way of providing journalist protection through an international body of some sort? Would that be more acceptable? It seems to me that you either put your life at risk, in which in many cases people die. Just in the Bosnian War, the first year of it, something like 25 journalists were targeted and killed. Multiply that by the years of the wars in succession. Is there a way?
I don't see it. I mean, look how ineffectual the conventions against torture and human rights councils are. I mean, these have a much broader mandate to protect the rights of, you know, refugees and the displaced and political opponents. I don't see any functional bureaucracy coming out of an internationalized effort to protect journalists. I mean, I think the Committee to Protect Journalists, which has only been in existence for about 20 years, I know I started with them very early on, and I mean, they serve as a good voice. They spotlight abuses and targeting and jailing and killing of journalists, but, you know, they're basically powerless to do anything more than call them out on it.
You can't expect some Serb sniper is going to suddenly, you know, get morality and say, oh, I shouldn't shoot journalists. But you can tell Western governments, you can tell clients, you can really put pressure on your own governments to put pressure on their client governments. Why is Morocco arresting and torturing journalists? Why are the Jordanians, the Israelis, you know, the Saudis? I mean, you can go on and on with the governments that rely on our support for their, literally for their existence in some cases, going in and abusing journalists. So in that sense, if we educate American people more and Europeans to put more pressure on their governments, but, you know, we can't even get people to not have their homes foreclosed. So on the list of getting Americans, what are they going to, you know, complain about? The fact that foreign journalists are being tortured by their governments, probably not going to work. But that's, I think, the only space that, we can have.
It's funny you mentioned Morocco as an example. The CIA renditioned a number of terror suspects to Morocco and outsourced the torturing so that their hands would be clean. And the U.S. courts have refused to even give these guys, who have since been exonerated and released, a day in court. And both the Bush administration and the Obama administration continue to apply the seal of, you know, state secrets to these cases so that there's no recourse. And, you know, if we don't even stand up for the rights that we have on our books, that are our constitutional promises and guarantees, I cannot foresee anybody going out of their way to protect journalists.
Terry, you mentioned at the very beginning how much things have changed. And interesting that you're from Ireland, because I've spent a lot of time there. And that was a place where journalists interviewed paramilitary leaders and the governments all the time. And I think one was killed during the entire Northern Ireland conflict.
I would be with Carol. I don't really see any help in getting governments involved in some kind of treaty to protect journalists. After all, half of the membership of the United Nations would have no interest in free press whatsoever, for starters. This is an organization that will put, you know, Libya on a human rights council. It's not going to work. Journalists generally do their best work in the cracks between the walls. Once we start getting regulated, it'll all go out the window. The flip side of that is that the truth will out. Probably the most dangerous country in the world for journalism right now is Syria. And yet the amount of information that's coming out from a country that is literally under siege is remarkable. And it's coming out mostly from ordinary Syrians who are brave enough to go out on the streets or go out on their balcony with their iPhone and take some video and then post it on YouTube. So the truth will out. That is heartening to me because it shows me that even in the most repressed countries who have no history of free press, nobody would ever accuse the Syrians of having a free press under Bashar Assad, but nonetheless, the ordinary civilians, they want to get that news out. And I think that's where we need to operate. It's always going to be slightly in the shadows, away from the control of whatever government body wants to put their official version of what's going on out there. Ireland is interesting. If you compare Ireland to Syria, I think the reason why no journalists were killed in Ireland is because, for all the hatred that existed between those two communities in the north, they have a very long tradition of a free press. And so the idea of the paramilitaries on either side killing journalists would immediately alienate the general population on whose support they rely. When you go into some of the countries where we're seeing conflict now. They have no history. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, well, Pakistan's slightly different. They have a very, very free press there, a very irresponsible press. But Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, there is no tradition there of a free press. And so the value of journalism, they expect journalists to be representatives of their government. And similarly, when we come there as outsiders, as American journalists, well, they think we're representatives of the American government, so we're fair targets. So I think it kind of depends a lot on what the local understanding of free press is, how journalists can then operate in that situation.
Claudia, I'm going to hand this to you. And also, they've actually paved the way for you to talk about the social media aspect and how that interacts because of the ability of local journalists to capture things on their phones and in their blogs.
I just want to make a quick comment about protection and the situation in Mexico. I interviewed the head of the state police department in one of the north states. I don't want to say which one because he's still in charge. And I want to get his opinion about a massive killing. There was 18 bodies. So I want to interview him, and I was in front of him. And before my first question at all, he showed me his boots. And he said, "Do you like my boots?" And I was like, "Yeah, nice." And he said, "Well, you know what? Those belong to one guy what you just killed. So what was your question?" So he grabbed the boots for somebody, for a body. And he don't have any issue to tell me, you know, "I steal these boots for a body." And he was the head of the state police department. So that's a protection. On the other side, I did a story about human trafficking, slaves, here in San Jose, here in California. When I talked to one of the supposedly victims, she said, "I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid." She didn't want to collaborate with the FBI. And I said, "Why not? I mean, you can apply for a human trafficking visa. You can be here legal and, you know, push for the American dream." And she said, "When I was crossing the border, I was hiding, and I hear how the trafficker, he paid the border patrol, and he said, 'Hey, another two are coming, so I just want to make sure that they're going to cross.'" And this officer said, "Yeah, no problem. How can I going to trust if I hear this American official working with them?" So narco trafficking is a business, and you don't want to mess with this business. Either it is American authorities or Mexican authorities. And there's corruption and there's insecurity in both sides of the border. Victims don't trust even in American or in Mexican government. They know what's going on. And the number of cases of corruption are growing in both sides of the border. So we have a serious issue here. In terms of the social media, yeah, it's really important. The tricky part with social media is there's no education. There's no protection. I mean, people just go and click and make some comments. And now they're the targets of the narco trafficking. They know, I mean, when people think a narco guy, it's somebody, you know, kind of uneducated or the border, or, you know, kind of big mustache and things. That's just a myth. These people is involved in technology, big business, people who know how to track information. So even now, the local people who want to share, they don't have any special training how to protect yourself when you post something on Facebook, how to kind of get some code that nobody can track your post. I think Mexican citizens need something like that, urgent, journalists, and we don't have that available. I don't even get any training. I need to go and ask and look somebody who can help me. How can I post something in a secure way? The other thing, journalists are now facing friends who are in their Facebook, in their social media, and now they're part of the narco trafficking. So you have this involved in your own social media network. It's a war even in the social media with the Mexican journalists.
Which is, again, that whole issue of trust. Who do you trust? How do you know when your fixer is actually an informant? How do you know when your Facebook friend isn't an informant? Why don't we see if there are a couple of questions in the audience? Let's start over here.
Thank you very much. Regarding social media and specifically WikiLeaks, just today it seems they were declared enemy of the state or something like that. But being that journalism is changing and I think less and less can be done by people like you, or it's a lot harder to be done by people like you, and more maybe can be done by citizen journalists, not as good, but at least more. How does WikiLeaks come into this, and how much should we protect or be worried about this criminalization of an organization like WikiLeaks?
I think we should be very worried. I'm not here to pass judgment or defend Julian Assange's personal life or anything like that, but I do know someone who works in the Arab world, the stuff that WikiLeaks leaked, that organization and what it did, there would be no Arab Spring without WikiLeaks, because it released information that showed Tunisians what our government thought about their government and really helped delegitimize them. If anything, America is more secure because of WikiLeaks, but look what's happening. And it's not just WikiLeaks. Chris Hedges' work on showing the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, and how that's being used potentially to indefinitely detain even journalists. If you have a progressive president, quote-unquote progressive president, being this vigorous in going after those who would expose the truth, what's going to happen when you get a quote-unquote conservative president? I mean, how much worse can it get? So I think it's absolutely crucial for people to fight for that. But again, I think this is part of a deliberate policy of the elites in this country. You know, you keep people so worried about just keeping a job, they can't worry about all these other things that make democracy function well. And that's the same in Egypt. You know, it took 30 years in Egypt or in Tunisia for it to get so bad cumulatively that people just said enough and were willing to die to revolt. We're nowhere near that, obviously, in this country. But you see all the strategies that are being done. It's just slowly closing the box on our ability to have an informed democracy. And that's the biggest disaster you can have.
I was just going to say I agree, and that branding WikiLeaks and Assange as criminals doesn't change the fact that a lot of what he exposed were things that the American public should know and the international community should know. A lot of what he exposed were inconsistencies in the rationale for some of the military decisions that have been made. Maybe there were state secrets disclosed in the odd case, but you know, they're branding the entire public disclosure of these communiques as national security violations when, you know, there might be a few of them in there, but I think on balance, the American public has benefited from these disclosures.
Have any of you read cables for your respective reporting, the cables that were, so you have, Carol, you relied on it quite a bit. You know, there was a special in The Nation that looked at the impact that WikiLeaks had on Latin America, and there were just so much learning that went on that people started to understand what was going on within their government. There was just massive amount of information that should not have been classified and should not have been secret if we really want to have democratic countries in any form or shape. Why don't we start a little line? 1, 2, 3, 4.
First, I want to thank everybody for coming. This is an extraordinary night, and what your work has done is amazing. Back in the 90s, before embedding, I worked for an NGO based here in LA that was working in war zones in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Somalia. I'm sure you know them. It was my job to get reporters and photojournalists into these war zones. And just two very quick questions. One of the things we dealt with, particularly in Rwanda and Somalia, when children were the targets, we dealt with tremendous post-traumatic stress. We, to this day, 20 years later, the images are still there, and nothing's going to change that. And the second question is, if you had read David Rhodes' book, The New York Times Reporter Who Was Kidnapped, what got me about his book was the guilt he felt. And I was wondering if you would comment on his perspective on that as well. Thank you.
I'd like to broaden that. We've got trauma. We've got guilt. We've got sympathy because, as I mentioned to Terry beforehand, the journalists in Ireland, the war correspondents, couldn't stand seeing another person die. And that was part of what motivated them. But you've also probably got a lot of anger about some of the injustices. How do you deal with these emotions? Do they motivate you to do a different kind of journalism or more or better? Or do you shut them out so that you can try to be more objective?
One of the things that Terry said is there are images you see that we don't see. And that's what I was exposed to. We had to censor a lot of the images. So, you know, for everybody here, you're seeing things that never get made public.
Terry, why don't you start?
I think it's a good question. Without wanting to elevate the role of a foreign correspondent, because PTSD is something that is widespread amongst our military now. But they have the Vets Administration, and there are programs to help them. I think it hasn't really been looked at enough. A lot of journalists do have some problems, and I have friends who have problems. I think we've hidden them a lot. You know, this cliche of the hard drinking from the war correspondent. A lot of the time, I think you can look at the roots of that abuse of alcohol and sometimes drugs from what they've experienced. And of course, as Carol said, you know, you don't go into this job to be a war junkie. But the flip side to that is you become one because, as you can tell from Carol's long and distinguished resume, once you've done a few wars, your bosses think, oh, he or she gets it. So, you know, next crisis, put her on the plane and fly her in. And so you accumulate over the years a bunch of wars, and yet you're meant to be indestructible because you're not being shot at. You're not a soldier. So it's okay. You can just check out a hotel and fly to the next war. And I think a lot of journalists probably don't even realize what they're struggling with. You know, divorce rates are very high for foreign correspondents on top of alcohol and drug abuse. I think a lot of it might come from that, not really very well recognized. How do you approach that? I don't know. I think you have to look at health programs and individual employers because there is no vets administration for journalists. But you're right to point it out. It is, a serious but really unremarked and silent problem.
What about how these emotions work within your profession? Do they motivate you to do a different, better job?
Real briefly, for me, I will tell anyone who wants to listen, and I've shared that with you already tonight, war is terrible. Don't ever think otherwise. It may be necessary sometimes, but you know, glamorizing war, thinking we can do a clinical job. The things that I've seen over my career make me want to never see another war again. I know there will be more wars, but that's what motivates me and my current job, LA World Affairs Council, where we're trying to program to explain what's going on in the world to Americans, Angelinos. There's a similar notion here. You need to understand war is the worst thing in the world, and we should do everything we can, negotiate up to the last minute before midnight before you pull that trigger, because it's not a solution to anything.
I would add that I did actually find it motivational when I witnessed some of the most horrible things that were done to children. In Sarajevo, the Serbs would shoot into schools and hospitals, you know, little six-year-old kids seeing their teachers blown up in front of them, ending up in hospitals with a bunch of, you know, fighters talking about how they're going to go and kill the Chetniks. I mean, just being ingrained with this violent outlook from very young age, I never felt so relevant in my life as when I was covering the Balkans, because the world was trying to turn its attention away from that conflict. It got very little press in the first couple of years, and the bad guys, you know, the ones who were going after the most innocent and helpless targets, did this with impunity for the most part. I mean, there was a core of us that felt like, you know, we're going to stay here. We don't care how damn dangerous they make it for us, because the world needs to know what's going on here. And you just can't turn your back because there's not a convenient solution to, you know, send in aid and a UN contingent that was corrupt and basically trading on the sanctions. The role of a journalist in that kind of circumstance is unique, and it's very empowering. I mean, those things were difficult to see and experience, but they kept me there.
Claudia.
I just want to add, I feel privileged because I have the opportunity to go find my stories, document my stories, my videos, and have the opportunity to come back with my family in a safe place. A lot of my colleagues in Mexico, they don't have this privilege, and it's a horrible situation. And not just that, a lot of them flying out of Mexico and looking for refugee in the United States. Right now, America doesn't have an asylum program for Mexico. They have an asylum program for other countries, but not for Mexico, because we don't have a war. But a lot of my colleagues are here as undocumented people, suffer with stress, depression, a lot of mental issues, and they don't have the right to go and look for assistance. Others are in detention center, federal detention center. Let me tell you, a federal detention center is just, it's hell. You basically are victimized. It's a place when you don't have contact. You don't even have contact with somebody who offers spiritual advice, something. You stay there for months without contact with family. So after all that you suffer, you go in this detention center and wait for 6, 7, 8 months by yourself in a jail. Why? Because you look for a better life, because you look for a refugee. And this option is not available for Mexican journalists.
Mark Levine?
Yeah, I would just say, I think a lot of people, you become less nice of a person. I've been told that by my wife. I'm not as nice as I used to be 10 or 15 years ago. I don't know if that's true, but I've been told that enough. So it probably, you know, you just become a harder person. But then again, I think of being in Iraq, for example, and that was history being made for me as a historian. And I felt I had literally a professional obligation to be there and to try to understand it from that unique point of view that even a great journalist, you know, just have different skill sets and different knowledge bases. So I felt someone had to be there who was a historian to help document what was happening real time, regardless of the risk, because that's your job. War is bad, right? War is horrible. The blood, the smell, everything is horrible. But try telling that to someone who's been playing whatever, Halo or whatever the hell the latest first-person shooter video game is, and they're so inured. I don't know that as much as you can tell them. I try telling my son that violence is horrible, and I've seen nothing compared to what so many other people have seen, but it's just horrible. But everything they're exposed to is saying the exact opposite, that violence and blood and death is good, and it makes you powerful, and it's cost-free. And of course, if you're living in these countries, you don't have to be told that, right? But I think so many people here don't get it. So I think that's one of the most important things that makes it worth, that makes it relevant. Isn't just that you're telling the story of those whose voices are being snuffed out, like let's say the Bosnians during that conflict, but that somehow you can get people in your own culture to understand the implication of what is being done in their name. But you're going against a massive, I'd call it a conspiracy, you know, that unites the military and corporations to create this image of war and violence that as if it's cost-free for those on the trigger end. And I don't know how you do that, but I know it's really important.
That concludes the special edition of the Scholar Circle, reporting from the Danger Zone. Thank you to our guests, Carol Williams, Claudia Nunez, Mark Levine, and Terry McCarthy. Extra special thanks to the Los Angeles Press Club and to Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, who produced this program with me. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of this program, you can go back to the KPFK archives, or you can check back with us at armudian.com or scholarcircle.org and follow us at armudian. See you next week.